Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley, and we have today the second half of my interview with Douglas O'Regan, the author of Taking Nazi Technology. I highly recommend the first half if you haven't already listened to it. Thank you, and please enjoy.
All right. So, so far we've talked about, how the Allied powers, but obviously they weren't the only player. Like, how did the Germans react to all this, right? To these people coming into their factories, to these people, threatening or offering to take them away? I suspect that this was different in East and West, but, what was the German reaction to this idea of sort of taking the knowledge base of German industry?
Yeah, not so different in East and West as you might guess early on. There were a lot of people, a lot of German scientists and technical people who actually were really impressed by the Soviet Union going into the war in terms of capacity or even in terms of the society. There were a decent number of ardent communists and socialists in Germany. So as the war progressed and it became more clear that the Nazis were going to lose and people started thinking, okay, what's my next move? You do see a lot of discussion about, well, do I want to flee east to the Soviets or west to the Americans? Now, the Red Army was pretty brutal. You probably don't want to go to the Red Army when they're first pushing in. But after the war, once the occupation has started, do I want to suck up to the east or the west? That's a real question for an awful lot of German scientists in the early stages. And so you do see a lot of people who were trying to figure out their next move, thinking about that strategically, because there's mass starvation in Germany. People might have resented this more, or I'm sure they resented it anyway, but they might have resisted it more, this effort to take the German scientists to these jobs in other countries if they had jobs at home. But in a occupied Germany where people are starving, where their families are starving, trying to find any possible work, the idea of a decently paid research job in the U.S. or U.K. or Soviet Union, as far as people were aware at the time, Stalinism was also very much about secrecy, so people weren't hearing about all the difficulties in the Soviet Union necessarily at that stage. That sounded pretty appealing to a lot of people. So you actually saw people trying to choose who they would be captured by, who they would advertise their skills to. And, von Braun is a case just very, very consciously chatted with his team about who do we want to surrender to, the Americans, the British, the Soviets, how do we want to do this? And then von Braun went out by himself to find the Americans and surrender to them so that they could be sure that they're the ones who take him, and sort of said, my whole team or nothing. I don't know, that's probably some bluff, but nonetheless, people resented it for sure. You did see some signs of resistance. I don't know how much that didn't remain in the records versus how much it didn't happen. I saw one anecdote where it was an American GI writing, and he wrote up to a factory. He had been told to take this and that scientist and this and that box of papers, and people said, well, what if I say no? And the GI said, well, I don't have any authority for violence. But I think you should come with me. And they said, well, what if we don't really want to go? And he said, I think you should come with me. And sort of the implied threat was there. It just, unless people pushed it, which I don't think they ever really had much inclination to do at the end of the war, it didn't come up as often. You did see people jailed. You did see a lot of these people swept up and put into specific internment camps for scientists and technicians called Ashbin and Dustcan, I think are the names, where people could be interrogated, especially higher ups in the Nazi establishment. But you didn't see quite as much sort of sabotage as you might imagine or anything like that. I think people saw it as a way to leverage their skills, their expertise, and also to sort of get by in this circumstance. Though you did see an awful lot of complaining about it. And in the post-war years, you see a lot of German writing in sort of popular press about how exploited the Germans were and how this was a thing that set them back. How much it actually set them back is not quite so clear, because the West German economy really boomed right in the years following all of these efforts. East German economy, not quite so much, but also not necessarily damaged by this per se. So
it'd be, well, I mean, this is a
This is a point you're making in German consciousness and in German writing, but I don't know that it was something that people were writing about at the time.
Right. I mean, and this is the point you make, which sort of people were aware of at the time, right, which is that these questions here, sort of intellectual property, and we should perhaps resist the essentializing of intellectual property and just call it know-how, but know-how and human capital and so forth are things that can be shared, right? And yeah. So that the others were learning what Germany had was not necessarily an infliction of damage upon Germany.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the key things. We think about technology, and at least I think pretty often when I think about technology, the thing that leaps to mind for me is like a cell phone. You know, this thing that if you pick up the cell phone and you give it to somebody else, I no longer have it. When it comes to ideas, how do you produce something? It's not nearly so clear. I mean, there are secrets mm-hmm. in the world. The trade secrets, they're often called, or you know, how do I produce this thing? Very famously, the recipe for Coca-Cola is not something that's publicly available. It's very, very carefully locked away. But by and large, what sets one company apart from another isn't that they have some true secret process that no one else knows how to mix the chemicals in this specific way to make their thing. It's just that you're better at producing it. You have people who've been doing it for a long time or know how to do it in an effective way with the same equipment, or you have just a long tradition of how to do it, and you know all the cool little secrets that make it work, then that's what really sets apart a lot of successful businesses from less successful ones and gives reputation to companies that they produce really high quality stuff, that they don't have as many products you have to return. And so that all those little things gathered together, people started talking about as the know-how. And they really only started talking about that in this era. And that, over the course of these investigations, became an obsession of a lot of the investigators. How can we gather this know-how? And that question, I think, really reshaped how each of the allies went about trying to acquire German science and technology.
So is this question of know-how, I mean, I'm sort of going to combine, well, I mean, we'll answer them in tandem, but, and I may be forecasting a little bit here, but you know, so there's a degree of disappointment among the Allies, right, that in the end, and you make this point, right, and from the American perspective, it's not even quite disappointment, it's like surprise that American industry was more advanced than German industry in a lot of these questions, right? You know, why was it that you know, the Allies ended up kind of disappointed in their haul of technology, right? It was something about Germany. And you made the point in the book also that, you know, Germany had effectively been cut off from a lot of scientific knowledge in the 1930s as the Nazi regime sort of demonstrated its noxiousness. But, you know, is it something about Germany? Is it something just about the way that knowledge moves that disappointed these countries so much?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both, especially depending on which power you're talking about. If you look retrospectively at the economic statistics, you know, as we were saying earlier, Japan had more or less caught up to Germany in a lot of industrial production ways around this era. Even earlier than that, by the 1910s, 1920s, and 1930s, the U.S. was really the leading power in a lot of industries and a lot of sort of meta-level industrial measurements, a lot of technological ways, the amount of science being produced. All these things had increased dramatically in the early 20th century and late 19th century in a way that I don't think had quite processed into Americans' idea of their place in the world fully until around World War II, when suddenly, very consciously, the U.S., for a lot of different reasons, is now in this sort of leadership position. And so going into the war, there is still this idea that there's so much to learn from Germany. I think in a lot of cases in the U.S., when they got there, what they found was that the U.S. way of doing things was actually already as good or better, or at least good enough that trying to translate things that were how they worked in Germany into the U.S. wouldn't necessarily make sense. I mean, among other things, for quite a few years, a lot of the German economy during the war had been built on using slave labor for heavy industry, for producing high-tech things like the V-2 missiles, relied extensively on slave labor. That warps the way that your technology works when you're not trying to, you know, do things efficiently given, you know, within these parameters. Now you look at totally different ways of producing things. It doesn't necessarily mean it's the best technology, even in an area like the V2 where the Germans were really advanced. It doesn't mean anybody else would want to follow those exact same ways of producing them. So in a lot of...
Well, I mean, the V2 is legendary for being one of the only weapon systems that's more deadly in the testing process than it is in its actual execution, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. Also very scary, though, which is a non-trivial thing in war. You know, the psychological effect of the V2, I think, is a lot more powerful than the actual, you know, destructive power of it. But yes, it's a really harrowing story of how it's produced. And you know, we were getting to the memoirs of the scientist walking to work and just sort of staring straight ahead, not paying attention to the bodies of people who'd been enslaved and now were hanging by their necks to encourage the others to work harder. Really, really, really nasty stuff. But so the broader point being that the way things were produced in wartime Germany didn't necessarily mean that the technologies were advancing in a way that would be useful to anybody post-war, but especially not the U.S., who were already in such a strong position industrially and technologically coming out of the war. So I think a lot of the lesson for the U.S. was we should take on a more assertive leadership position. We should start licensing out our technology to others rather than trying to slavishly learn from the Germans. We should try to export our technology as a way of building alliances. We should start working from a leadership position in a lot of these technologies. That's a different lesson than you get from other countries who weren't in the same position as the U.S. So you do start seeing people, especially in the U.K., who really want to learn some of these German technologies to build up these export industries so they can start paying back some of these debts. They really do care about learning from the German technology. They're not finding – to some degree they're finding the same thing, but they're also finding a lot of stuff they really want to learn. And they're not getting it. You start seeing all these reports over and over again how we're not capturing the know-how. These reports, no matter how good they are, they're just not capturing this know-how that we really need. And the only way to do that is to spend time working with the people on the ground in person. There's actually a great book, Drawing Theories Apart, by David Kaiser, who talks about in the same, roughly the same period, theoretical physicists having a hard time even sending some of their ways of doing theoretical physics to other countries, unless you send the person along the way. Other physics equipment, also same story. When you're trying to build your very first cyclotron, you can't learn it unless you have somebody in your lab who worked with a cyclotron in person. Otherwise, no matter how good your reports are, you're just not getting it. That becomes something people are noticing a lot more in various venues in this era. And in the British case, this means they want to send British people, engineers, low-level people, not just the high-level businessmen, to spend time in Germany, not just to write up quick reports, but to work in the factories, to spend time picking their brain and trying to do some test runs of things. And so the entire effort pivots from writing these reports to spending time in Germany. But that also has some side effects. If you're writing reports, you can share those reports with the Americans and hope to get more cooperation from the Americans in other areas. You can't really share with your allies the time that your engineers are spending on the ground in Germany. It becomes more of a zero-sum game, some country actually benefiting with their allies not necessarily doing so. So there are some diplomatic costs to doing it this way at a time where being close with the U.S. is a really high priority for the U.K. as well. And so you start seeing in each of these countries efforts to deal with this question of the know-how. In the U.S. case, maybe less so because they're learning that they already have a lot of know-how specific to U.S. production. That means they don't have quite as much as they thought to learn. But in the French case, as we've talked about, building up the Franco-German institutes where they could learn the know-how of German science in person. In the Soviet case, taking German scientists in the U.K. And then once actually East Germany is set up, you do start seeing, again, some collaborative facilities where German scientists and engineers and technicians, or you know, in some cases just plain industrialists, are producing with Soviet supervision and with Soviet engineers shadowing the German engineers so that they can learn these techniques and bring them back to the Soviet Union well into the East Europe Cold War era. So this is a change that at first I thought was just a funny quirk of this term. Maybe people were just talking about it in this way. This term know-how, we still have it around today. It doesn't necessarily have a clear definition.
You can do a Google Ngram of it, though, right? I mean, when you do it, and I've done it before, yeah. Right? I mean, after reading the book, I've done it, and you can see how the usage of the terminology changes.
Yeah, and I thought at first that, okay, I know this term know-how. It's kind of funny. It keeps coming up again and again. And then I talked about that for a while with my advisor, Catherine Carson, when I was back in the dissertation stage. And she said, well, why are they talking about it that way? You should think about that some. And so I went and did some research on it. And yeah, as you say, the term hadn't really ever been used before around this period. It existed before that, but it really came.
Okay, well, let me pause you right here, because sure. I want to sort of frame this in terms of the final two questions, mm-hmm. which are gonna answer this. And this is obviously a subject I've been intensely interested in for a while, with sort of the focus on IP, but I've also, some of my dissertation work was on sort of transnational determinants of military doctrine, right? So how militaries learn from one another. So this idea of how knowledge moves back and forth, tacit knowledge or explicit knowledge, has been intensely interesting to me. And there's a lot of good recent work on this, right? I mean, Richard Baldwin's book, The Great Convergence, John Krieger's work on how knowledge moves and so forth, right? But this is sort of really what comes through in yours. Like, so, and you talk about it not just in terms of know-how, but you also talk about it in terms of like the impact on library science, right? Like, this experience is transformative to how people think about knowledge in a way that we don't understand, right? In the way that we don't sort of really grasp, right? The effort to like loot the entire, and I don't want to use the word loot in a, overly descriptive fashion, but the idea to sort of take the entire knowledge of a nation and incorporate it is sort of tremendously influential on how we do knowledge transmission in the modern world.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not what I came into this book expecting to be a topic that I really paid much attention to, and it came out of the book being the thing that I was fascinated by and wanted to write 3 or 4 books about different topics related to, because you do see going into this, people not really having, I'm sure people had thought about this in some way or another, but not really forefronting it in their planning and not really having the language for it. And early on, as people get frustrated with taking German science, start talking about, is there this sort of what the Americans call the know-how? Is that the thing that's the problem?
It's philosophical, right? I mean, like, yeah. Michael Oakeshott and others, like, and Carl Polanyi, right? They're framing this philosophically before we're seeing it. But this is a really good practical application.
Well, they're framing that after the war, after all this effort.
Oh my goodness, is that after?
Yeah. Polanyi is 67. He starts writing about it in the 50s. You start seeing a couple other philosophers talking about know-how and sort of this question, that term specifically, but also the question a lot more in the early 50s, late 50s as well. So mm-hmm. I can't give you the sort of causal arrow here for sure and say that this struggles to get German technology caused the philosophy thing. That would be a stretch. It'd be really cool if you could prove it. I don't think you could.
But it's really interesting. It's a really interesting idea, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I love about this, is that this hard-nosed world of business, the law, these are not people who spend a lot of time sitting around thinking about, philosophy of knowledge and, mental states and what is it, is technology part of society? It seems like a sort of a broader question that academics might be worrying more about. But the academics seem to pick it up about 5 or 10 years after it becomes a really big deal, talked about all over the business press and these top industrialists trying to do the practical work of it. And then the lawyers come in and have to try to conceptualize this know-how thing into the law. And it just doesn't fit in the law of most countries. You can sort of define something by going back to a whole bunch of cases and find something that is the basic same idea, right? This isn't a new idea. The guild system was based on this in the early modern era. They would train people through having an apprentice, and that apprentice would spend years working with you and then would transmit that by going elsewhere and learn more skills and then teach themselves to new apprentices. That's all very much based on the same idea of tacit knowledge, know-how, whatever you'd want to call it. But But it becomes a much bigger deal in this era. And I think part of that is the technologies, microfilm especially, and then really soon after that, computerized information technology systems, we call them today. Those, as is true today, people look at information technology and say, well, this solves all of our problems. Now we can share any amount of information we want. Information will become free. Everyone will have access to all the brilliant knowledge that's ever existed, and therefore there won't be any more bad politics or there won't be any more mistakes. Everyone will know everything. And of course, we know that's not actually the case. These don't solve problems by themselves. They solve some problems, but not the bigger problems. And yet it really increases our estimation of how easy it is to do stuff. I think that's part of why people were so ambitious in Germany. They thought, oh, we can do this so easily with microfilm and with computerized information technology that's developing. And that led them to sort of new problems along the way, because you can't necessarily capture it in that way. And so now all this information is available, and you're still not getting what you want. You're still not really getting the technology you want, despite having literally millions of frames of microfilm describing the process. So what's missing? It's all the other parts. It's the parts that make you go from having a blueprint of a factory to having a factory that actually produces efficiently. It's the difference between having all the equipment in a kitchen and having somebody who's cooked before and having them actually producing good meals on to order. That's actually a profitable enterprise. It's a huge gulf, and it's not something you can usually even write down or describe what it is that makes that difference. It's something you learn from experience. And so people start talking about the know-how more, I think, because all of the explicit knowledge is now so infinitely available in some ways. At least theoretically, right. You can get all the information you want.
Right.
So what's missing?
Right. And there are ways in which know-how actually is transferable by sort of these digital technologies. I mean, I have used YouTube videos in really sort of productive ways, right? In things that I would never understood, I would never have been able to do without sort of paying attention to YouTube stuff, right? But and that itself, right? I mean, I think that is, Baldwin and others have talked about this anyway. So, but for me, it's an intensely fascinating intellectual question. So to drag this back to the national security question before we get too off topic onto my efforts to make meatballs or something, but how does sort of your work here leave you? Because like reading your work leaves me frustrated in the way people have conversations about the Chinese taking American military technology, right? Yeah. Because, to frame it in really sort of obvious terms, we had the entire country to take everything we wanted from, and we still didn't get quite what we wanted. The Chinese are just getting bits and pieces from our companies. And so why are we so alarmist about how the Chinese are stealing our knowledge when we have these sort of, we have what should be the foundation of a much better understanding of how knowledge transfers from our own past?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple slices to this. I think the main thing this book should make you skeptical of are the articles you see every now and then, data breach, massive information loss through cyber espionage. The Chinese have learned everything there is to know about this technology, and we've lost billions and billions of dollars along the way. By the way, we should bulk up the cyber defense initiative at the Defense Department. I think that's something you should be really skeptical of, because again, all the written information in the world is valuable. I mean, no one's saying that you don't learn anything from it or that it's something that has no value, but it doesn't get you all the way there. And in fact, some of the most important pieces are what's not there. Even after World War II, when the nuclear secrecy became such a big deal, you saw a nuclear scientist saying, well, the only secret of how to build a bomb is that it could be done. And, the sort of smaller details of actually how to go about doing it. But there's no real secret of the atomic bomb after it had been done. Scientists in a lot of countries could have figured that out. It's the industrial production and the smaller details and know-how that actually keep you from being able to build a bomb in your backyard or, in whatever other country you might want to. And when it comes to Chinese espionage in the U.S., which is a thing that exists, so I think there's also a lot of jingoism and, 20 years ago it was Japan. Before that, it was, someone else. But there is espionage out there for sure, and there is a lot of interest in taking American industrial technology. I think cyber espionage is not the thing to focus on. If you want to focus on something, I think it is the flow of people. But at the same time, there's a lot of research out there now from a lot of different economists, from a lot of historians looking at different types of technologies that shows that really, while you do maybe lose something in terms of secrecy and moving people from place to place, you actually gain a lot more when it comes to your own innovation, to have this injection of different experiences, different backgrounds. So one economist, Petra Moser, has looked at, after World War II, in those industries where German scientists predominantly came to the U.S., did it benefit the industries where they came in compared to other related industries? And she looks at the patent records and she sees, yes, there's inventiveness increases, you know, there's more patents filed within an area, let's say a sub area of chemistry where there were more Germans who came over compared to a sub area of chemistry where fewer Germans came over. Now, there's pretty good evidence there. But what might be more surprising is that in those same industries in Germany, those industries benefited. And there's a lot of other research.
That's interesting. Oh, yeah. That's really interesting.
There's similar research in other areas, a lot of different types of patent-based measurement, because patents are easy to count. It's the evidence we have in front of us. But this shows pretty convincingly that when key innovators, the people who filed the most patents within your firm, or even mid-tier people, move to a new firm, it's not just the company who they go to who benefits. It's there's actually an effect of increased inventiveness over the next 5 or 10 years at the company they left. It's building up these networks that really builds up the innovative capacity and really is a stimulus to both the company that, in theory, loses their technology or loses their monopoly on somebody who has this know-how. In theory, they should lose. But in fact, both sides of this come out ahead in the long term when talent flows from one company to another. And so that's, I think, the model we should really be taking away when it comes to Chinese scientists and students coming to American industries. Sure, it's possible that there are some bad actors who are going to smuggle some amount of know-how or secrets back to China, but also we're gaining from having brilliant Chinese minds in the U.S. working with our in our own institutions. And I think in the end, we're going to see an awful lot of benefit from that, even assuming that we're not just talking about a tiny fraction of people who are, you know, these sort of bad actors. So there are two sides to it, both that the cyber espionage, I think, is overestimated as a threat, and also that we're misconceiving the movement of know-how as a threat. I think it's as much an opportunity as it is a threat. And in the case of Germany, as I mentioned before, all these efforts didn't hurt Germany in any sort of clear way. West Germany had what's been called the economic miracle in the years immediately following this. And I think at least one part of that is that having all these Germans move to other countries and having all of the American scientists go to Germany and see what can they produce, how do they produce it? Having that information helps you build an alliance after the war and say, I want to partner with you to distribute my product in Germany. I know for a fact that you can produce this, or I'd like to license your technology. I know for a fact that you have this technology. I wasn't able to learn all that much about it, but it seemed interesting. How about you send your people over here for a while? Or we send our people over there. And so you see booming flows of technology through these long-term partnerships after the war that were at least one part of what made West Germany succeed economically after the war, despite having everyone know all of their secrets in theory. You know, there's no evidence really that West Germany suffered that much from all of these enormous efforts. And I think that also is a model we should be taking away when it looks at policy today.
You know what, Douglas, I think that's a great close. And Douglas, this has been absolutely fantastic, these two podcasts that we've done. I'm delighted that you could be here. This is intensely interesting from a public policy and from a theoretical perspective for listeners and readers of Lawyers Against Gun Money. We would love to have you again at some point, especially to talk about trade secrets, because I am intensely interested in your next work.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.